Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's my colleague, Ira Melman.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is lashing out at China's Communist Party for being truly hostile to the United States, slamming Beijing for exporting an authoritarian system, pressuring American companies, and using coercion to advance maritime claims. The secretary addressed an event sponsored by the Hudson Institute in New York Wednesday.
China's regime trampling the most basic human rights of its own citizens, the great and noble Chinese people. We've seen this in Hong Kong, where they need to live up to their promises and commitments, and we've seen it in the gross human rights violation of ethnic minorities in Xinjiang. We know, too, that the Chinese Communist Party is offering its people in the world an entirely different model of governance. It's one in which a Leninist party rules and everyone must think and act according to the will of the communist elites. That's not a future that I want. I think it's not a future that anyone in this room wants. It's not a future that other democracies want. And it's not a future that the people of China, the freedom-loving people of China, everywhere, don't want this model.
China has pushed back on the U.S. assertion, saying Washington is smearing Beijing's policies. Pompeo also laid out some key areas of U.S. competition with China that included the economy, military, ideologies, and international orders, all the while expressing an optimistic view of the future.
We don't want a confrontation with the People's Republic of China. In fact, we want just the opposite. We want to see a prosperous China that is at peace with its own people and with its neighbors. We want to see a thriving China, where Chinese business community transact business with the rest of the world on a fair set of reciprocal terms that we all know and understand. And we want to see a liberalized China that allows the genius of its people to flourish. And we want to see a China that respects basic human rights of its own people, as guaranteed by its own constitution. But above all, it's critical that as Americans, we engage China as it is, not as we wish it were.
The top U.S. diplomat was questioned about the U.S. stand to date about protests in Hong Kong.
The Chinese made a commitment that we hope they'll live up to that. And at the same time, we're telling everyone that we interact with, we don't want violence. We think there should be a political solution to the conflict that's taking place there. I say this to my Chinese counterparts. I say this publicly when we want the protesters to hear this too. We don't want them to engage in violence either. We hope they can find a path forward that is consistent with the idea of one country, two systems. That's the commitment that the Chinese government made. We hope they'll live up to it.
Pompeo spoke about the status of U.S.-China trade talks, saying weeks before the world's two leading economies are expected to seal the Phase One trade deal to pause the months-long trade war. The State Secretary said, "We want to see a thriving Chinese business community that transacts with the rest of the world on fair and reciprocal issues." We invite you to read more on our top story. Follow us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. We continue now. Police and protesters engaged in a standoff in Hong Kong's nightlife district Thursday after pro-democracy demonstrators urged people to celebrate Halloween by wearing masks in defiance of a government ban on face coverings. Riot police pushed people back slowly from the Lan Kwai Fong area of bars, nightclubs, and restaurants that is usually abuzz with revelers on the holiday. Anti-government protesters in Hong Kong, now in its fifth straight month of demonstrations, say they're seeking greater rights and freedoms amid what they perceive as growing repression by Beijing. That's a call that resonates with the city's sexual minorities who are looking across the South China Sea to Taiwan, a self-governing Chinese territory that has challenged China's strict legal and social viewing prohibiting gay abuse prohibiting gay marriage. VOA's Anita Pell has more from Hong Kong.
Freedom, the rallying cry of Hong Kong's five-month-old protest movement, but also the long-term goal of the city's small group of sexual minorities. As protests continue amid what protesters say is increased repression from Beijing, gay, lesbian, and transgender Hong Kongers say they, too, are worried. As protests raged noisily in the streets, Hong Kong's courts recently, quietly, batted down a legal challenge seeking gay marriage. Taiwan, the Chinese breakaway province that flouted Beijing by legalizing gay marriage this year, heralded the ruling with a blowout pride parade this month. Hong Kong's first and only openly gay legislator, opposition lawmaker Raymond Chan, says he believes that the fight for gay rights goes hand in hand with the protest movement.
China's encroachment continue to frighten our way of life, our freedom of expression. When the majority of Hong Kong people have no basic human rights, I cannot imagine the minority can enjoy the equality. Even more Hong Kong people support us, but the pro-Beijing lawmakers still very conservative. They will vote on all of this policy or ordinance in our council.
Protesters say Beijing is tamping down on freedoms in Hong Kong. Their demands include universal suffrage, an investigation of police violence during protests, and amnesty for protesters. The movement started earlier this year over a controversial, since-withdrawn extradition bill that would have allowed Hong Kong residents to be tried in mainland China. Human rights advocates say Hong Kong's legal system is less corrupt, more considerate of human rights, and more free of government influence than in China, and that Hong Kong's social values are more liberal. Organizers of Hong Kong's Pink Season LGBT festival, which spanned the month of October, had to cancel several events because of the city's protest schedule. Even so, the city's gay scene is thriving. But in this insecure time, cautious. The city's vibrant gay scene, members say, glosses over some harsh legal realities. Singer Shingaling says it has never been easy to be a lesbian in Hong Kong.
I'm worrying all my life, not just now. Like, I'm worried since I know I'm gay. Because there's no law protecting gay rights and no marriage. And you can even get, discriminated or beaten up, and then the guy won't get arrested.
One protester who gave his name as Jason and says he is transgender says he lives in fear of China's more conservative legal and social values. Since its handover to China in 1997, Hong Kong has been governed under a one-country, two-systems agreement that will eventually give Beijing total control of the city in 2047.
Hong Kong is very difficult already. You know, Taiwan is the first place in Asia to legalize gay marriage. And for Hong Kong, there's still a long way to go. And there are still homophobia in Hong Kong. But like after 24/7, we have to follow the laws of China. It would be more concerning because it would be even hotter.
But Pink Alliance, a local gay rights advocacy group that is politically neutral, says it has seen no worrying signs yet that China plans to clamp down on the community. Policy Chief Jerome Yao.
I think when it comes to LGBT issues, it's an internal matter for Hong Kong to deal with. As far as I can see, I haven't seen any intervention on Beijing directly. So I guess from that angle, I think LGBT rights is an internal matter.
But the chill is felt in this balmy city. Writer Beatrice Wong, who is transgender, says she cherishes her ability to freely express herself in Hong Kong and will continue to do so.
Now that I had a girl's body, we're entering nightlife, was like discovering a diamond ring in a trash can. When I told my friends about such encounters, they got concerned and warned me about protecting my body. But I am proud of my new body. It's a miracle, and I want to share it with the world.
She says she thinks everyone, in Hong Kong and beyond, should be able to do the same. Anita Pal, VOA News, Hong Kong.
With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Stay with us. There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
VOA Asia continues. The deaths of 39 migrants, many believed to be of Vietnamese origin, in the back of a refrigerated truck near London last week has focused a spotlight on the lives of those who risk everything to earn a better living in Britain. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, many Vietnamese are lured overseas by the potential profits of working in illegal industries.
An industrial park east of London. The tragic end to a journey that began with hope 9,000 kilometers away in the remote villages of northern Vietnam. Identities have not been confirmed, but the grieving has already begun. Sons and daughters seemingly lost to the brutal trade in people smuggling.
Many people in this village have gone abroad to work, so my son wanted to go abroad like others, to earn money.
That demand is catered for by well-established gangs, says Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch.
These are groups and gangs that operate with impunity in Vietnam. In many cases, they have connections to official authorities, so there is that corruption element going on, that allows them to offer to get people to places in Europe.
Family members say they paid these gangs up to $38,000 to reach Europe. Criminologist Paolo Campana is an expert on people smuggling networks.
What we see is a fragmentation and a compartmentalization of the smuggling. So in a sense, you don't have a Mr. Big controlling everything, but you have fairly small, rudimentary organizations that might take care of each stage in the journey.
The human cargo is transferred at handover points en route.
Migrants have to make incredibly difficult decisions over whether to trust smuggler A or smuggler B. Word of mouth plays a very large role. In other cases, for instance, the Syrians or the Iraqi, you also have Facebook groups or forums on the internet where smugglers advertise their services, and migrants can ask questions and can try to get more information about the service provided by the smugglers.
The driver of the truck, Maurice Robinson from Northern Ireland, has been charged with manslaughter, human trafficking and money laundering.
I would be very surprised if the people who were involved in the last leg of the journey, whoever they have been, they would have any knowledge about what has happened in China or in Russia or in Eastern Europe.
British police are searching for others thought to be involved.
We have people coming into the country, either being trafficked or as asylum seekers. And we know that the borders are very tight and complicated, and there are more and more chances being taken.
That chance ended in tragedy for 39 migrants seeking a better life.
There has to be, real pressure on Vietnam also to end these kind of people smuggling arrangements.
Experts say clamping down on people smuggling gangs requires better cross-border cooperation. But as long as there is demand, the gangs will continue to prosper. And this will unlikely be the last tragedy. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Fire swept through a Pakistani train Thursday, killing at least 70 people and injuring nearly 40 after a gas canister that passengers were using to cook breakfast exploded, according to government officials. Reuters' Megan Revell reports.
A fire swept through a Pakistani train on Thursday, killing scores of people and injuring nearly 40 in the country's worst rail disaster in nearly 15 years. Government officials said a gas canister exploded, which passengers were using to cook breakfast. But several survivors questioned the official line, saying they believed it was due to a fault with the train's electrical system. The disaster occurred in the south of Punjab province. The train was travelling from Karachi to the city of Rawalpindi, where a religious conference is taking place. Many died after leaping from the moving train, trying to escape the flames. Pakistan's colonial-era railway has fallen into disrepair due to chronic underinvestment and poor maintenance. meaning accidents are all too common.
That was Reuters reporter Megan Revelle. U.S. President Donald Trump had planned to meet with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the APEC gathering in Santiago, Chile next month. The meeting, many said, was to possibly announce some sort of deal on U.S.-China trade. White House Bureau Chief for VOA Steve Herman is with us. Steve, what happened, Steve?
Well, what we know, Ira, is there's not going to be a meeting between President Trump and President Xi in Santiago next month. And that's because of the announcement by the Chilean president, Sebastián Piñera, that the APEC summit, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting, is not going to be held there because of the situation on the ground in Santiago, where there's been an anti-government protest going on for some weeks and has been violent at times. So if they are going to meet, it's going to be somewhere else.
Has there been any notification from the White House, or at least any indication from the White House what might happen next?
Well, the White House was caught by surprise that the APEC summit was being canceled. There's not a secondary site prepared. The White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley, who I spoke to a couple of times today, said that the administration's awaiting potential information regarding another location. And he said that the White House is still looking forward to finalizing what the president's called phase one of what would be, in the views of the president, a historic trade deal with China within the same time frame. And he says, when we have an announcement, we'll let you know. So everything basically is up in the air right now.
Do you think there is any way that those involved can find a secondary gathering for this meeting, which had been postponed anyway? It was originally scheduled for Brazil, and it was moved to Chile.
Right. It's looking like it's a very low possibility that we're going to see an APEC summit next month. What is possible is that President Xi and President Trump will meet somewhere. The APEC summit was ideal because this would take place on the sidelines. It's a neutral turf. It's not President Xi coming to the U.S. or President Trump going to China. And we could see something like we viewed a couple of times with President Trump and the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, where they met In a third country. But that was a more elaborate event. We're not expecting anything quite that elaborate because it appears that the Chinese weren't looking to make a huge deal out of signing a partial trade agreement. But one thing we've seen, Ira, in this White House, things can change very quickly. The president can be impulsive. I'm talking about the U.S. president, and could get on the phone with President Xi and work something out on short notice.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman joined us via Skype. Thank you, Steve. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website.
There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue with VOA Asia Weekend.
India will formally split up occupied Jammu and Kashmir into two federal territories today. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government withdrew occupied Kashmir's autonomy in August, but in addition, it also announced its division into two territories to be directly ruled from New Delhi, one consisting of Jammu and Kashmir, the other the remote Buddhist enclave of Ladakh. Joining us on VOA Asia to talk about this is Sumit Ganguly, distinguished professor of political science at Indiana University. Professor, can you explain what these separations mean for the countries involved and the people who live there?
Well, to begin with, it ends Kashmir's special status in the Indian Union. Under something called Article 370, Kashmir had a separate constitution. It had its own legislative assembly, and there were a whole series of other provisions of the Indian constitution that did not apply to Kashmir. All this has been stripped away in one fell swoop. Now the question is how the Supreme Court will decide, and in fact, I think the decision is almost imminent.
When you say almost imminent, could it come out today? Could it, could this wipe this away by a decision of the court on this day, or do you expect a little lag?
The court merely has to affirm or deny the decision, and the court has the power to actually deny the decision because the decision to revoke Kashmir's special status had been challenged in court, and it remains to be seen how this panel of judges of the Supreme Court comes down, whether they are persuaded by the government's argument or the arguments of those who are aggrieved.
And what's your prediction on this?
The Supreme Court is not predictable. On occasion, the Supreme Court supports the government. On occasion, even in contentious issues, it has ruled against the government. So, and this is such a fraught issue. People will be watching this with, you know, much anticipation in New Delhi and in other regional capitals, most notably in Pakistan.
Are you telling me now that the separation has not officially been implemented? And if not, why is there so much violence there? But there has been violence there for decades now. But nevertheless, it seems like there is increased violence.
Well, since the decision of early August, there has not been substantial violence, largely because there has been a military clampdown in the state. There is a enhanced paramilitary and army presence in the state, and much of economic life has come to a standstill. There have been a few sporadic attacks, but nothing of any significance. But India cannot sustain this level of military presence indefinitely. And furthermore, normal commerce, normal trade will have to be resumed. And that has not happened since the decision of early August. And so matters are really in quite a disturbed state in the entire region.
What has life been like for people there?
Everyday life is extremely hard because there are significant limitations on movement. Many shopkeepers, as a form of protest, are keeping their shops closed. While landlines have been restored, to the best of my knowledge, the internet has not been restored, and consequently, this is causing considerable hardship for the population. And I think only a limited number of cell phone towers have been reactivated. So even cell phone coverage is rather constricted at the moment.
What happens today when officially this goes into effect? Will that mean any change as far as their lives are concerned or how the regions are governed?
Well, much depends on how the decision comes down. If the decision is in favor of the government, I suspect there will be further unrest in the state. There will be greater unhappiness, particularly in the Kashmir Valley, where the grievances are the most pronounced. In other parts of Kashmir, there could be rejoicing in Jammu, for example, or in the northern region of Kashmir in Ladakh, where the move actually has been welcomed. But the heart of the contention really lies in Kashmir, in the Kashmir Valley, and that's where we may witness further unhappiness, grievances coming to the fore, and then, of course, new political arrangements over the next several months will have to be worked out. where Ladakh would not have an assembly, but Jammu and Kashmir would have an assembly. It remains to be seen how elections would be conducted. We are really in uncharted territory at the moment.
Can these moves change relationships that India has, or Pakistan has for that matter, with China, Russia, the United States, other countries with whom they have dealings?
Not with the vast majority of the countries that you mentioned, but India's view is if it can successfully pull off the measure that it has undertaken and can restore some semblance of normalcy in the region, then effectively the dispute with Pakistan is over, and that would free India up to concentrate on its northern border with China, which is the subject of a substantial border dispute harking back to the 1950s. But much is hinged upon India's ability to bring about some semblance of normalcy with the in the region, which it has sought to integrate into India more fully. If it can actually do that, then for all practical purposes, the Indo-Pakistani dispute will have come to an end. One may not care for the manner in which this has been carried out, but I think that's the strategic logic underlying this decision.
Dr. Shamal Ganguly via Skype from the University of Indiana in Bloomington.
With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Stay with us. There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. In Myanmar's Kachin State, 8 years of conflict and displacement have caused some civilians to turn to drugs as authorities struggle to control and rehabilitate heroin and amphetamine addicts, both in the refugee camps and cities across the state. Users and officials tell of the struggles both on and off the battlefield. Steve Sanford filed this report for VOA.
Here in Kachin State's biggest IDP camp, economic instability and the hardships of war have left some civilians turning to drugs as a coping mechanism. For those working outside the camps, a rise in drug production that has been linked to organized crime and armed groups, including Myanmar government forces, have kept camp officials busy enforcing the law.
We lived in the IDP camp near the China border, and there are many drug dealers and users along the border. When we hear people in the IDP camps are addicted to drugs, we will investigate and find out who is using. We will have the leaders of that section in the camp find the person and take them to a rehab center.
At a nearby clinic run by the anti-drug vigilante group Pakistan, many of the addicts become drug dependent to offset laborious jobs demanding long hours. Jade mining in Kachin State generates big revenue, and cheap heroin is readily available for miners like Latar.
I only use drugs while I'm working at the jade mine and searching for jade. I don't take drugs all the time like the other people do. It's only when I'm working. I took heroin when I was with friends, and then I realized I was addicted to the drug.
Some of the addicts have reoccurring bouts with the drugs and are forced to revisit the centers where treatment includes religious lectures and physical discipline. Seng Nupan's mother had to shut down their market stall when the fighting spread in 2011, so Nupan began selling drugs to help feed the family.
I have so many friends, and they beg me to help them to find the drugs. I help them to buy drugs from our township and bring it back to the community. That's why I started taking drugs from this point.
As many political roadblocks remain on Myanmar's road to peace, observers expect the drug trade to continue unabated. Steve Sanford for VOA News.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Ira Melman and I have more great stories from the past week to share when VOA Asia Weekend continues in just a moment. VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
Hong Kong authorities barred pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong from an election as the city's leader warned Tuesday that months of violent protests have pushed the city to the brink of recession.
On Tuesday, Wong confirmed the ban on the grounds that advocacy for Hong Kong's self-determination violates election law. He called the move political censorship.
Now, I become the only candidate banned from running in November's district council election. The decision to ban me from running office is clearly politically driven. The so-called reasons is judging subjectively on my intention to uphold basic law. But everyone would know that the true reason is my identity. Joshua Wong is the crime in their mind.
Wong has not been a prominent figure in the last 5 months of sometimes violent protests, which are largely leaderless. However, he has a high profile abroad. Wong went on a tour to the U.S. and Germany this year, lobbying for overseas support for the protests. Beijing has said that it strongly disapproved of his meetings with foreign politicians. Chinese state media has called him a pro-independence leader, a claim he denies. Barring Wong from elections is likely to fuel further discord in Hong Kong. He urged protesters to take the streets this weekend, which is expected to be filled with violent clashes. Long-running protests have taken a heavy toll on the city's economy.
That was Reuters correspondent Ryan Brooks. In comments likely to further anger protesters, the chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, said there would be no political solution until the violent protests gripping the semi-autonomous Chinese territory come to an end.
The most effective solution is to tackle the violence head on. For the government to resort to measures that will appease the violent rioters, I don't think that is a solution. And I feel that many of Hong Kong people, yes, they may have some unhappiness and grievances about the government policies, about the government handling of this major crisis. But the time now is really to put in all our efforts to say no to violence in order to have a chance to put an end to this extreme violence that we have seen.
The 23-year-old Wong became known as the young face of Hong Kong's umbrella movement that peacefully occupied streets for 79 days in 2014. He since has been repeatedly arrested and jailed. He's played a smaller role in the current protest, those whose leadership is more diffuse, but China's communist leaders have targeted him in accusing foreign powers of colluding with anti-China separatists to foment unrest. Wong posted on his Twitter account a copy of a letter ruling invalid his nomination as a candidate in the November 24th local district council elections. The government confirmed Wong's disqualification without identifying him. The letter said Wong's embrace of the concept of self-determination includes Hong Kong's independence, which violates a requirement to promise to uphold its constitution. Wong denied that, saying his answers to the officer's questions were twisted as part of a mind-reading game.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Ira Melman and I have more great stories from the past week to share when VOA Asia Weekend continues in just a moment.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
It's the end of another week. Sit back and relax as we continue with more VOA Asia Weekend.
China Tuesday promised more improvements in conditions for foreign companies, including an end to officials pressing them to hand over technology, a key irritant in its tariff war with Washington. The announcement adds to a drumbeat of market-opening promises by the communist government, which is trying to make China's cooling state-dominated economy more productive. Beijing also will ease restrictions on foreign competitors in some newly opened finance businesses, according to the Commerce Ministry. Complaints about Beijing's technology ambitions helped to spark its tariff war with President Donald Trump. Trade negotiators are working out details of an October 11th agreement under which President Trump delayed a planned tariff hike on Chinese imports. Trump said Beijing agreed to buy more American farm goods in exchange, though China has yet to confirm details of that commitment. China's direct investment in the United States has slowed to a trickle, dropping 80% from 2016 to 2018, according to New York-based research provider Rhodium Group. Among the hardest hit sectors are real estate and hospitality, with Chinese investors no longer scrambling to buy prime properties in cities like New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on what's behind this downward trend and how it's impacting one American city in particular.
The Los Angeles skyline can be seen from Stephen Chung's office, but something is missing, and what he is not seeing worries him.
The skylines are no longer filled with cranes or supplied by Chinese investments coming over here. What we're worried about are the construction that's already here that cannot be finished because of the financing situation.
Chung says one example of this is the billion-dollar Oceanwide Plaza, located in a prized location near the Los Angeles Convention Center and the complex where the Lakers and Clippers play basketball. Work stalled in January for this condo, hotel, and retail space, and Chung has seen very little activity since then.
In terms of people moving to that location and actually the retail activity that's going to be there, that's revenue that we will not be getting as soon as we hope.
The standstill at Oceanwide Plaza is but one sign of a sharp drop in capital flowing from China at a time of heightened tensions between the two superpowers. Overall direct foreign investment between China and the U.S. peaked in 2016 to a record $60 billion, then dropped drastically, according to the Rhodium Group. One reason is a change in China's monetary policy, says Los Angeles-based land use lawyer Dale Goldsmith.
There were the currency controls out of China where a lot of companies were parking money. I think it was probably to get money out of China and into a safe investment. And at the end of the day, the Chinese cracked down on that.
Another reason is increased vigilance by a federal watchdog organization, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. The Rhodium Group estimates the committee's scrutiny has led Chinese investors to abandon more than $2.5 billion in U.S. deals. A relatively strong U.S. economy is another factor.
The dollar has been very strong, making investment a lot less attractive for the Chinese in the States. On top of it, you'd have skyrocketing construction costs.
To top it all off, a trade war persists between the U.S. and China, sowing uncertainty in an already challenging investment climate.
Part of the reason why we're seeing really not any new projects coming from China is because of the China trade war. Not knowing the future, and as the tensions escalating, I think a lot of the Chinese companies are wary in terms of whether they should enter the U.S. market.
The trade war is creating another trend. To avoid high tariffs, international companies are moving manufacturing out of China and into Southeast Asian countries. In some countries, it's creating new wealth. Others are trying to increase their direct foreign investment to offset the trade war's negative effects in their own countries.
Specifically, Vietnam and Indonesia. Over the past few years, they've been a lot more active seeking for business opportunities.
So long as economic tensions remain high between Washington and Beijing, Los Angeles and other U.S. cities will have to look elsewhere for investment capital. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. There's much more right after this. VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features. With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue with VOA Asia Weekend.
In Santa Fe, New Mexico, a unique college has been immersing students in Native American contemporary arts and culture for more than 55 years. This one-of-a-kind school draws both Native and non-Native Americans from across the country who wish to explore their artistic abilities while learning more about the diverse range of Native cultures in their homeland. VOA's Julie Tabo takes us on a tour.
The Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, stands out against the stunning desert landscape of the American Southwest. Here, on this sprawling 56-hectare campus, about 500 students are immersed in contemporary Native American arts and culture. Institute President Robert Martin, who is Cherokee, says members of about 100 tribes on average attend the school.
That's a lot of diversity, and of course we also have non-Native students as well. We're open to everybody, but our mission will always reflect that indigenous or Native perspective. I think that's important aspect of what we have here is a sense of community, almost a sense of family.
Daniel Yazi Natonaba feels that connection.
Growing up on the reservation, I was entirely isolated. I was surrounded by, you know, other Natives of the similar tribes. And my whole perspective of the world was just Navajo. But when I've came here, I've learned other perspectives of Yaqui, Tohono O'odham, Pueblos.
My work is paying homage to the people who raised me.
Dolores Scarlett Cortez is exploring her roots through printmaking and photography.
Growing up, I felt like I was really missing that kind of side of me because my parents never talked about it. What I'm hoping to do is go back to my community to document the people back home that I really care for.
That feeling of giving back to the community is not unusual among the students, says Martin.
If you ask the average college student why they're going to college, what they're going to do with their degree, they'll say, I want a job. You ask our students and they'll say, I want to be of service to my family and my community. And so that makes our students different.
It's called shelter.
Student Daniel Forrest appreciates that unique perspective.
I'm learning how to walk differently, really pay attention, because Western culture tends to be a little conquistador, a little aggressive, and you just take that with you wherever you go in the world. It sort of suits you for the most part. That doesn't work here. So I'm learning to just recalibrate everything.
I always wanted to bring something back to my culture.
Many of the school's graduates return to teach there years later. Anthony Dieter, who graduated 25 years ago, teaches a new concept in filmmaking, a digital dome where viewers watch moving images on a spherical screen rather than a flat one. The new technology is very fitting, given his native background.
We're indigenous cultures, and we are not linear. We're spherical. We're round. And I'm going, so all of a sudden, here's a media that's totally immersive for us to tell our stories actually in the round.
Which is technologically and culturally a perfect balance, he says.
I think they estimate since the inception of Hollywood, 4,000 movies have involved Native Americans. My challenge to the industry would be this. We've heard what you have to say about us. Now you're going to hear what we have to say about us.
The students are expressing their voices loud and clear, on campus, at the school's museum, and all around the world. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Santa Fe, New Mexico.
We stay here in the United States now. Fires continue burning in California, leading to the evacuation of thousands of people. Gusting winds are spurring officials to shut off all power, or at least a lot of it, out of fear that a spark could cause devastation. Throughout the state, people are struggling to cope. Michelle Quinn has more.
These are dry and dangerous weeks in the state of California. Thousands of people in the state's north and south are fleeing their homes to escape fires. So-called wind events, with gusts up to 90 miles per hour have led electric companies to preventively shut off power for nearly a million people. And then there's the smoke. These trailers are set up to help people without power. It's a place to charge a phone, work on a laptop, grab a cup of coffee, or plug in a medical device. Jana Cole stopped by the center to work.
I think I'm kind of thrown off the rails a little bit because I'm unable to meet deadlines.
She isn't alone. Others here are trying to keep their lives going, even without power.
I want to keep track of how our schools are doing, which schools are open and closed.
I've essentially been running my business from my phone.
The state's governor declared a state of emergency, and firefighters are battling an estimated 330 fires across California. On Monday, a lull in the wind gave firefighters an edge against the biggest blazes in the northern part of the state. But near the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, the fire grows. And another wind event is expected Tuesday. For residents, there's a sense of unease with every crossing of an intersection on the road with no lights, with every breath of smoky air.
When my son woke up this morning, he thought it was inside the house because the smell was so strong.
People here say they are used to thinking about earthquakes, a potential disaster that comes with no warning. But now they have to worry about the wind, also unpredictable, which can turn a spark into an inferno.
From Florida, we experience hurricanes, but this to me is a little bit scarier than that. Earthquake and fire to me is more like, I don't know, more frightening.
It's another bracing California moment to realize how much depends on infrastructure working, including the life of a pet lizard who has to stay in a certain temperature range. This store in Berkeley is accepting lizards and snakes whose owners had to evacuate their homes or are living with no power.
He's ice cold.
As the fires and winds seem to work in unison to destroy, Californians are adapting. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Oakland, California.
Hong Kong has fallen into recession. The city's financial secretary says Hong Kong is unlikely to achieve any growth this year in the wake of 5 months of anti-government protests that erupted in flames over the weekend. Paul Chang said in a blog post Sunday that numbers to be released later this week would show two successive quarters of contraction, and that'll be recorded, and that technical definition of a recession is what that adds up to. Our VOA colleague Steve Miller reached out to Roger Baker, Senior Vice President for Strategic Analysis at American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform and publisher Stratfor, to talk about the situation.
The economic impact is certainly being felt finally, and it should have been expected and anticipated. It is an economic impact, though, that is in part as strong as it is because of other underlying issues. For example, the U.S.-China trade competition, and that has had a huge impact. Overall slowdown in Chinese economic activity, which has had a pretty big impact on Hong Kong as well. So this set of protests right now has been a bit of a tipping point beyond for those economic activities. I think that when we talk about does this end or how does it end or is there a tipping point for the government or for the protesters, the Chinese government in some ways has been able to utilize what's going on in Hong Kong as a way to emphasize that democracy is not always the best and most stable way to operate, nor is it necessarily something that's good for economies. And so the Chinese government has gained a little bit out of this in regards to talking about Hong Kong in their own country and in, quite frankly, sympathetic countries around the world who have also looked at how much of a role the government should have in business and whether or not democracy is necessary for economic activity. So I think that is something that means that, you know, as we went into the protest, people thought, oh, if there's violence in Hong Kong, Beijing is going to have to go in. But maybe it doesn't have to go in, and maybe Beijing accepts that over time, the role of Hong Kong is going to be weakened. It's going to create these rifts inside its business community with the protesters. And the value of a unique Hong Kong is going to slip inevitably anyway.
Do the optics of the protests and the water cannons and the continued controversy week after week have any negative impact on China per se?
Well, one of the things is Beijing hasn't let Chinese National Police or Chinese National PLA or People's Armed Police or anything like that go into Hong Kong. So this is still the role of the Hong Kong police, not the Chinese state police. Second, quite frankly, I know there's talk of will the protesters get protest fatigue, but I would argue that in general, the West has gotten protest fatigue and started to not look at this nearly as strongly and raise it up nearly as much as they were in the first couple of rounds of violence. So that attention has started to wane, and that may actually wane further as the U.S. continues through this issue of impeachment and the upcoming election cycle.
One of the things that the protesters are continuing to chant these days is five demands, not one less. Can they ever realistically achieve their other four demands that they're seeking for, the universal suffrage, Carrie Lam stepping down, the police investigations, or has Beijing and the Hong Kong authorities pretty much drawn a line in the sand? Is there any room for negotiations that would be meaningful to the protesters?
There is room for four of the five demands. Carrie Lam, there's been, you know, the rumors up and down about her offering to resign in the past, about her potentially stepping down in the future. It wouldn't be surprising if she does not serve out her first term. On the government appointing a more independent investigation into the police, they've already started saying that if the current investigation, which is supposed to finish around December or January, is not accepted by the people, then maybe they'll go for that. Giving freeing the protesters from detention and potentially expunging their records, I think those are within the realm of reality, even if not probable. But that fifth demand, the universal suffrage demand, which is effectively a self-determination demand, that is the one place where I think Beijing simply cannot and will not give in.
Roger Baker, Senior Vice President of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform and publisher Stratfor, talking with VOA's Steve Miller.
There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese to get your free Chinese language iPhone app from VOA.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue with VOA Asia Weekend.
Success on the international trade front is a top issue for U.S. farmers. As VOA's Cain Farabaugh reports, this segment of the American landscape, which largely voted for President Donald Trump in 2016, faces difficult economic conditions ahead of next year's presidential contest because of higher costs to operate farms, falling profits, and an uncertain trade environment.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPP, the United States signed with 11 other countries in 2016, would have given U.S. farmers more places to market their crops. Despite then-candidate Donald Trump's promise to withdraw from the TPP, largely on concerns over the impact to U.S. manufacturing jobs, Illinois farmer Wendell Schauman supported him, despite wanting the TPP agreement.
You're a farmer, you have a PhD, you're well-traveled, you understand how trade agreements and international trade works. And you voted for Trump.
Yes.
Since 2016, not only did the U.S. withdraw from the TPP, it dismantled the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement. A replacement, the United States-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, or USMCA, is under review in the U.S. Congress. Meanwhile, the Trump administration simultaneously is waging a trade war with one of its biggest crop buyers, China, which imposed tariffs on U.S. corn and soybeans in retaliation for U.S. tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. This has affected profits for Shaman, but not his support for Trump's re-election.
What I hear on the other side, I'll happy to support what he's doing versus what they're proposing.
Shaman, who worries a Democratic president may impose environmental regulations affecting his farm operations, is not alone.
I was excited to see a Republican take back the White House, but I love the stance that we're taking.
I think he's doing what is right.
I think the majority of our people by far are still supportive of the president.
Illinois Farm Bureau's Mark Gebhardt says Trump has been able to blunt the impact of tariffs through payments to farmers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Market Facilitation Program. This year, it cost taxpayers about $16 billion, on top of roughly $15 billion in 2018.
We want trade, not aid. We don't want to have to live hoping that we get another round of market facilitation payments. We really need, again, to find just a final way forward on not only the tariffs with China, but USMCA, Japan, EU, all these other issues that are out there.
Yet the lack of substantial trade progress during his first term causes concern among some Trump voters.
I really feel like he doesn't understand what happens out here in these flyover states. He's walking a very thin line with what's been happening in the ag sector.
Megan Dwyer says the Trump administration's waivers for oil refineries to use corn-based ethanol, the president's tweeting, and his mixed results on trade could affect her vote.
Some of his comments recently around ag are frustrating to me.
Amid an ongoing impeachment inquiry in the U.S. Congress, a straw poll conducted by Farm Journal Pulse in September showed 76% of 1,138 farmers polled support Trump in 2020, down from 79% in July.
I think there's a lot of people who are disappointed, but it's going to come down to the choice they give us. And right now, for most farmers, I don't think he's going to lose many.
Kane Faribault, VOA News, Kirkwood, Illinois.
The Jaipur Literature Festival began in the city of Jaipur, India. With 300 speakers and over 400,000 visitors every year, it is the world's largest free literary festival. The festival also travels internationally. One stop is Boulder, Colorado. Shelley Schlender has more.
Every year, the Jaipur Literature Festival comes to the Boulder Public Library. The festival gives visitors a vivid weekend of music, along with a personal connection with authors from many backgrounds. Festival director Namita Gokhale says the goal is a multicultural celebration.
Joy is the most important element of literature, of arts, of everything to do with communication, because when you have that, you have empathy, you have all the emotions follow from joy.
Palestinian-born physician and author Izzeldin Abulesh has dealt with more tragedy than joy. 10 years ago, Israeli soldiers shelled Abulesh's home, killing his three daughters.
But I can keep them alive in my heart, in my soul, in your hearts, in your souls, not with the bullet or the shell. It's with wisdom, with kind, courageous, strong words, and with good deeds.
For her historical novel, Ethiopian-born Maza Mengistu looked for hidden voices.
Yeah, because this is not just a book about Ethiopia. I think this is a book about every woman and every girl who's had to survive some kind of conflict, whether it's in war or in the home.
Mengistu's book recounts Italy's 1935 invasion of Ethiopia. Her research included recollections from her Ethiopian grandmother. One audience member says that touches on heartbreak.
When my grandmother immigrated from the former Yugoslavia to here after World War II, that was something that she never talked about. My grandfather never talked about it either. And one, I think she brought up a good point where she was like, you know, my great-grandmother, who did seem to live through some of this, you know, nightmarish war and everything, this nightmarish takeover, she never thought it was important, or she didn't think she needed to share it.
Women, girls, we silence in some ways protects us until we hear somebody else's story and understand that we're not alone. Yeah.
The Jaipur Literature Festival also travels to Houston, New York, and other countries for the deeper understanding of the human experience. Shelley Schlender, VOA News, Boulder, Colorado.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.